This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today we're going to talk about creativity and the systems that make it possible. Jim Davies understands this topic well. A cognitive scientist, he's the director of the Science of Imagination Laboratory at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario, and his work looks at how people use visual thinking to do everything from solve problems to imagine new worlds. He's been called the next Malcolm Gladwell, and in his research, he's used scientific findings to explain everything from how we portray aliens on TV to why religion makes us feel one with the universe. He's also a professional artist, swing dancer, calligraphist, and published author who's currently working on 5 books simultaneously. Today, he'll help us better understand creativity and appreciate that more isn't always better. He'll also share his own strategies for thinking creatively and the unique processes he puts into place. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by BNY Mellon Wealth Management, who knows that your investment decisions define not just your future, but your legacy. BNY Mellon Wealth Management knows because they know you well. This gives them the insights to help grow, protect, and transfer your wealth. Visit their brand hub, Worth Knowing, on entrepreneur.com to learn more. Disclaimer, BNY Mellon is the corporate brand of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation and its subsidiaries. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Great. Hi. How are you doing?
Why don't you get us started about how a guy with a computer science PhD ends up writing about aliens and religion?
I started off in philosophy just because I was interested in it, and I really didn't have much idea of what I wanted to do after that. And in my final year of college, I sat down with my chair of my philosophy department, and he asked me if I'd ever heard of cognitive science. And he lent me a book, and I went home and read it, and I had one semester to prepare for my future. I ended up going to a master's degree, getting a master's degree in experimental psychology. And I worked in artificial intelligence at Los Alamos National Laboratories, and finally did my PhD in computer science, specializing in artificial intelligence at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. But the entire time I was interested in the mind, how it works. And so there's, of course, philosophy of mind, and psychology is about running experiments on people to understand the mind. And my work in computer science is doing computer simulations of minds. But, you know, all at the same time, I was doing art. So I was in theater and drawing and dance and everything else. And I got very interested in what science could say about art and how it's made and why it works and why it doesn't sometimes. And I was pretty busy getting my PhD, but afterward, I had some time to do some extra reading, and I started looking into the science of art and, you know, people studying what makes art tick and why it works psychologically. And in the course of doing that research, also discovered that there are a lot of similar things going on in the philosophy of, in the science of religion, the cognitive science of religion. And the book Riveted I wrote was kind of a result of 4 years or so of research into these things, trying to make a big theory of why we find anything interesting.
And explain a little bit about what cognitive science is for folks who may not be familiar.
Sure. Cognitive science is studying minds from an interdisciplinary perspective. So we've got linguistics and philosophy and psychology and computer science all trying to understand the mind from different kinds of angles. Where psychology is mostly focused on an experimental methodology where you run people through experiments. All the other disciplines have their own ways of doing things. It's also characterized by viewing the mind kind of as an information processor. So it's not always at the neuron level, that's a little bit low level, and it's not always just talking about how people act, but it's, you know, making theories about beliefs and interests and motivations and goals and how the mind processes information to explain why people are the way they are.
Why is it important to sort of study imagination. You know, your lab is it puts it front and center. Why is that so important?
Imagination is really broadly used in lots and lots of different parts of cognition. Certainly, when you're reading, you have imagination is used to help understand what you're reading. Use imagination every time you do planning. So if you're going to plan who's going to pick up the kids or what, you know, what you're going to have for dinner, that involves imagining future scenarios, right? You might imagine how your future is going to play out. All when you're dreaming, that's involved with imagination. So anytime you're trying to think about the way the world could be or could have been, or even more flights of fancy, like creating fictional worlds for novels or screenplays, you're engaged in the imagination. So it's a pretty important thing.
And do you think people discount the role that imagination has in their daily life? It seems to me most people probably connect imagination with, oh, I'm going to sit down and do a very specific creative task. I'm going to make a drawing. I'm going to write a book. Do you think that they're realizing that imagination takes them through everything they do?
No, I don't think so. I think part of it is because the word imagination in English has strong connotations of creativity. So when people are thinking about whether they're using their imagination, they often don't consider trying to picture where they left their car keys as using your imagination. But of course they are. They're imagining a scenario that's not in front of them, right? They're imagining, or even when every time you reminisce about something of your past, you're engaging your imagination to picture it in your head. It's just a quirk of English that we don't tend to think of it that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let's get talking a little bit about some of the research that you've done. There's an important idea in your work about this sweet spot that exists, as you call it, between familiarity and incongruity. Can you explain that sweet spot?
Yeah. When you engage with something, let's talk about a painting, for example, but really, it really counts for everything. There's got to be a certain amount of things in that painting that you recognize. When I say there has to be, I mean, for it to be really engaging, it has to have something recognizable about it. And that's the pattern part. And if there's nothing for you to really engage with, it's going to be a boring painting. So let's just take an example of a TV on a channel with no signal. It's just fuzz. Okay. That's an enormous amount of information, but there's no pattern to it. So we get very bored watching TVs on fuzzy channels, right? We don't sit there for hours watching them. However, on the other end of it, if there's too much pattern, it's boring too. So if there's just a painting of just a square, most people will look at it for maybe a second or two, and then they'll feel that they really get it. They understand that there's not more, they don't think that there's more that they can get out of it, and then they'll move on. So that's the pattern part of it. Now, the incongruity is the intriguingness of it. It makes you curious. It gives you drive to understand more. So when you see a strange picture, it might make you wonder what's going on. So let's say there's a painting of a person face down in a pool and there's a clown, you know, standing next to the pool. So we've got pattern because you recognize the clown, you recognize the pool, you recognize a person lying face down, but there's incongruity there. You wonder what does a clown have to do with a person in a pool? Is that person dead or are they just looking at something at the bottom of the pool? And it engages your mind. And so it's the balance between the pattern and incongruity, that's the sweet spot where things are the most compelling. Too much incongruity and no pattern, right? That's boring too. And like I said, the TV channel, that is all incongruity. A TV channel with no signal, it's all incongruity. So that's what I mean by the sweet spot.
Sure, sure. And how does that sort of tie into aliens and what that reveals about us? How does it tie into aliens?
So when we're talking about, okay, we don't have any real aliens yet. So we're talking about fictional aliens, of course, but the fictional aliens that we engage with in fiction, for them to be maximally compelling, they also have to have this balance of pattern and incongruity. So often they end up very humanoid. They have human-like responses and psychology. They often are bilaterally symmetric, which means they're the same on their left and their right. Many times they have a face with all the, you know, eyes and nose and everything in the correct places. And the incongruity part is actually very minor a lot of the time, right? So in Star Trek, for example, often the aliens just have a different color or forehead or ears or something like that, but they speak English and they get angry and, you know, they act basically just like humans. Okay. So it's these little nuances that make it interesting. Okay. just a normal human with no cultural interest at all is also, you know, somewhat boring. But at the same time, really weird aliens that are completely incomprehensible are often not, they're harder to relate to, and it's more of a challenge to make them compelling in a story.
Sure. And those aliens are usually about something else, right? Like the tentacle aliens in Arrival, for instance, or you and I spoke earlier about Solaris. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on there when we've created something that isn't humanoid?
Well, the aliens in movies like Solaris and Arrival are very strange, and they don't really do what I was talking about. They don't fit into that sweet spot. So there's a good question is, why are those movies still really good? Okay, and they are. They're very compelling, but they're compelling in a different way. They're going for a different strategy. Whereas Star Wars and Star Trek space operas like that often have aliens that are characters. They're real characters that you interact with, and they have politics, and they have interests, and they can deceive you, and they can cheat you. They're interesting for a lot of the same reasons human characters are in novels. In Arrival and in Solaris, the aliens are a mystery to be understood. And it's a little bit like a non-character mystery that's going on, trying to figure out why a disease broke out or something like that. You can have a compelling movie about a disease breaking out. The disease isn't a character per se. It's just a mysterious thing that you're trying to figure out. And I think those movies work in that way. So they can get away with having very incomprehensible, unrelatable aliens because they're not treating them like characters.
And what is the sort of the lesson beyond science fiction in relatability and how important that is?
Well, all stories work because of characters. And there's a lot of evidence in cognitive science and psychology showing that presenting things in terms of stories and characters and people is extremely important for getting people interested in it. We can even see it in education, like when we teach people about like water levels, you know, becoming level, or, you know, how water trickles down a mountain. It's sometimes helpful to tell the students, well, the water wants to get to the lowest level, so it will try to find the easiest path. You know, that's anthropomorphizing water in a way that, in one, you know, makes no sense really. But, you know, you describe it that way. Or we might say that, you know, a positive and a negatively charged molecule want to come together. They're attracted to each other, right? Even that word is anthropomorphic. And it helps us get it at an intuitive level. You know, hopefully you'll abandon that anthropomorphism eventually. But, you know, they even use it in science to teach it. Likewise, when you're talking about a business, say you're pitching a business or something like that, relating that business's vision in terms of characters and stories is just a much more effective way to help people get it. It's a lot of work to understand how things work in the abstract. And our minds are not built for it, frankly. So we can do it. We can understand purely abstract, but it takes a lot of work. If you're tired, you're low interested, if you're trying to sell somebody something, it really pays to have a more visceral description. And that usually involves emotional content and especially character and story.
And you and I talked before about James Cameron sort of talking about why aliens that are sort of too far afield will lose an audience entirely. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in James Cameron, he said in describing the design for his movie Avatar, the Na'vi, which are the blue aliens in that story, he said there's no scientific reason for them to look so humanoid, but he's making this movie for a human audience, not a galactic audience. And he wanted the audience to relate to these people and feel empathy for them. So they needed facial expressions. They needed to act like people. They needed to look a lot like people. And it would be a real challenge to try to make a version of Avatar with Arrival's aliens, for example, that are gigantic. They have no face. You can't understand anything they're saying. You wouldn't be able to relate to them, and you'd have to deal with them in a different way.
I think for any folks that are listening to this and they're wondering why on earth I'm spending so much time on fictional aliens, I think it's very important because a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of creators, sometimes they'll make something and no one knows quite what to do with it yet. And sometimes it's because people haven't caught up to them. And sometimes it's because they haven't found a way to connect it to the people that they do need to persuade in order to create, to get a groundswell of support, right? To test it, to have the next big thing. And so I guess if someone's listening to this, what can they sort of take from this to understand the importance of relatability in whatever it is they create, whether it's a work of art or fiction, or whether it's even like a tool or a solution for people? What should they be keeping in mind?
I go into this in a lot of detail in my book, Riveted, about what the foundations of what makes something compelling are. The short version is that you need to have it about people. It needs to have pattern and a little bit of pattern, a little bit of incongruity. You have to leave some things unsaid. You have to leave people with a little bit of desire to understand more. You don't want to wrap it completely up nicely so that they feel satisfied and can forget it. You want to engage their emotions, particularly, if you make them feel hope and fear. Those are some of the things to put in there that really make a difference. But the overall theme of that is that you want to appeal to things that would have appealed to our ancestors 200,000 years ago. And, you know, talking in raw numbers, there's a lot of evidence that shows that not only do people respond worse to numbers than they do to stories, but if you give them stories and numbers, it's worse than just giving them the story. So we have this instinct sometimes if you think, I'll tell them a story about why my product is good and then I'll back it up with numbers. That can backfire. Experimental studies often show, for example, when you're trying to get people to donate money to help, disease people with malaria or something like that, if you just tell a story of a person who got sick with malaria, it's better than giving statistics about malaria, and it's better than telling the story and giving statistics, which is kind of a depressing thought. But, you know, it really showcases how you need to appeal to the baser animal instinct that we, evolved on the plains of Africa in the Pleistocene.
You've also written a little bit about droids in Star Wars and sort of the role of masks. What can you tell us about this? I think it's there's some really interesting things going on there.
Yeah, Star Wars is an interesting science fiction example because it has a lot of prominent droid characters. Droids are, for those who don't know Star Wars, they're androids or robots. And many of them are humanoid. Some of them are not. In fact, the most beloved droid in the Star Wars universe is R2-D2, who is neither humanoid, We can't even understand what he's saying. He's a little bit like Toto from Wizard of Oz. He's a sidekick. He's always supportive of the protagonist and doesn't talk, right? But helps out once in a while and is cute and all this kind of thing. But there aren't any droids in the movies, anyway, that have actual humanoid faces that you can read. They've got sometimes voices, even R2-D2's voice, which is, we'd say it's prosody in linguistics, but the way we can tell whether it's sad or chuckling or excited or scared by the tone of its beeps and whistles. But it's very interesting that Star Wars manages to get us to care about droids, even though they don't really have facial expressions. And you can see the Star Wars also takes advantage of our propensity to care about facial expressions in dehumanizing the people that have to die. So the stormtroopers, for example, get killed all over the place. And in the prequels, the droid army, they're the main antagonists. And, Lucas, I think, was very wise in making the entire separatist army made up of robots, because seeing the so-called, the good Jedi killing off a bunch of human beings with lightsabers might be kind of disturbing. And as the movie plays it out, droid death is often humorous, right? They'll say, uh-oh, and then they'll lose their head and everybody laughs, right? People don't give a lot of thought to the fact that this droid is actually a sentient being that, might even feel pain. There's evidence in the Star Wars universe that droids feel pain. There's a torture scene of a droid in Return of the Jedi. But we don't care. They're not human. They don't have they don't really have a face or facial expressions. So we can kill them and not feel so bad about it.
And what should people be thinking about in their own lives when there's all these processes that are working without them even being aware, and it's helping them to feel a certain way? How can people be maybe a little bit more intentional, maybe, or try to be intentional about their reactions to anything, really, and understanding how they're perceiving something may not be totally in their control?
Right. I think understanding what makes things compelling is useful for, we've been talking about the reason of being able to make compelling stuff. If you're a painter or you're a business person, you might want to make yourself or your product or your artistic work more compelling. But the flip side of it is that if you know what buttons to press to make somebody find something compelling, then you can set up what I call a psychological immune system in yourself so that you don't get snowed by somebody who's trying to sell you snake oil, okay? So people who use humor and stories and, you know, gut-wrenching narrative, that can really push your buttons and really compel you, and then the convincing follows without you even being aware of it. So if you can put up a warning light, it's like, oh, okay, let's say an attractive person is telling me this, or, you know, they're using soft music to in an ad for a drug or something like that. You can step back and say, okay, look, they're really they're manipulating me, not necessarily in a bad way, but it is a manipulation to try to get me to feel more favorably about this thing than maybe I should, right?
What are other elements, say if somebody wanted to create their own sort of, immune system, their own psychological immune system, what should they be cognizant of? What should they be putting into that?
The basic rule, and it's not always going to work, but the basic rule is if you're facing a situation that your ancient ancestors on the, you know, living in the wilderness might have faced, then your instincts are probably okay. Okay. And if it's something very, very abstract, your instincts are probably wrong. Okay. So you don't, you know, like insurance, for example, if you offer somebody two different insurance policies and one is incredibly complicated and the other is very simple, which one do you think they're going to go for? They go for the simple one. But if the company offering those two choices has deliberately made the simpler one a better deal for them and a worse deal for you, they're taking advantage of your bias. So what do? You think, well, did my ancestors, you know, gathering on the plains of Africa have to choose between different insurance plans and measure these numbers and risk and variability and probability? No. That means you have to do the hard work and actually calculate which one's better for you.
So you have your own projects that you work on. You're a creative person. In the intro, I'd spoken about some of the things that you do from dancing to art, as well as all of the written work that you're working on. Can you tell me a little bit about the strategies that you use in your creative process?
Sure. I have a lot of methods there for idea capture and organization. So what I mean by idea capture is that I have a lot of strategies for making sure that when I have an idea, I have a way to record it and get it out of my mind and into some tangible form that I can later access. I have three main ways of doing that. The first is index cards. I keep index cards in my back pocket all times and a pen in my front pocket. And so I will often pull out the pen and an index card and jot down an idea. The second is I have a little app called ZipNote, and I can send myself an email with it very quickly. But, you know, I don't always have my phone, or it's not always socially appropriate to pull out your phone. So if I'm talking to somebody or I'm at a lecture and I pull out my phone, everyone assumes I'm on Twitter or something, even though I might be taking notes. I actually used to feel comfortable taking notes on a palm pile, but now with cell phones, I don't feel comfortable taking notes on my cell phone because I think people are going to assume I'm messing around. But it's somehow more acceptable to pull out an index card and write something down. The index cards are also great because you can hand them to somebody if you wanted to, you give it to them right away. The index cards can also go into manila folders very easily, or you can sort them and throw them into your bag to go home or into your suitcase to remind you to pack something next time. And then finally, I've got a memory palace, which is just a way to remember things easily. And it's based on locations in a house you know very well. So I will put things in the house I grew up in my imagination. So when I'm riding my bike to work, I'm a cyclist, and so I ride my bike to and from work. Now, I might think of four things I need to do, and I'll put them in different parts of my house. And when I get to work, I just go through the house in my mind and write down all the things I needed to remember. So what do I do once the idea is recorded? Well, I've got a system of physical notebooks, and I have notebooks, physical notebooks for project ideas. These are big ideas that are basically waiting for a student to work on in a research project. But most of my ideas and things I want to remember are stored in Google Docs, which is an online note-taking system. And a lot of people don't take advantage of Google Docs in the way that I do, in that you can turn Google Docs into your own wiki. You can highlight any text and press the, you know, the chain button or the link button and link it to another Google Doc. So I will often have, let's say I have a Google Doc on consciousness, and that's the main one. And it has links to all the other pages I have, the consciousness literature review and my thoughts about consciousness and the notes on a book on consciousness that I read. And so with all these things interconnected, I can be sure that when I want to do something about consciousness, I can go there and I know that everything that I've ever read or thought of that's relevant will be there, and I will have it all at my fingertips. Those are some of the main strategies that I use for organizing.
And what you also have a very unique process for note-taking after you read a book. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So reading is, you know, I'm going to sound like I'm saying something that's bad about reading. Reading is great, but ultimately it is consumption instead of production. And one of my rules of life is don't consume if you can produce. So you think about, why are you reading? Now, if you're just reading for fun, you know, you're reading John Grisham on the beach, okay, you don't have to worry about it. But if you're reading for a purpose, if you're reading because you need to learn something, or in my case, because I want to write scientific books, I want to write fiction, I read so that I can write. That's sort of the way I think about it. Well, if that's your goal, how do you maximize and optimize what you're getting out of a book? So the way I do it is, if I read a physical print book, I will make little marks next to passages on the page. I'll sometimes put in plastic flags to note where those marks are. If I'm reading a book on Kindle, I will use the highlighting function. You can't do that on Kobo, by the way, only Kindle. And then I have a special Chrome plugin that allows me to print out all my notes and highlights on Kindle. And those are the two main ways that I read books. And then when I'm done with the book, I go through and look at all of my notes and marks. Everything I've highlighted, every note that I made, I actually put that into a Google Doc too, and then I process it. Which means I'll look at every single one and I'll think about, why did I find that interesting? What is important about that in my life? And usually, it's because it relates to something I want to do or write in the future. So I will go back to my Google Docs and I'll put in something in the consciousness Google Doc, or I will add something to a book I'm writing on how to be a scientist, or how to write fiction, or imagination, or my sequel to Riveted, or something like that. And I force myself, this is something that people find strange, I will actually force myself to read the prose in a book that I someday want to write. I'll force myself to do it right then. So when you said I'm working on 5 books at once, you know, I'm not like actively typing 3 pages a day. But what it is if I read something I want to write a book called Riveted to Religion, for example. I want to write a book all about why we find religion interesting. And if I read an article about the psychology of religion, I will write the part of the book that will probably be published in 15 years. I will write that part in the book. And then, you know, when it's time to focus on the book, I've got this big Frankenstein of all these thoughts and papers and everything, and I start turning it into a coherent book, right? So it takes me a little bit longer, and I read slightly fewer books than I might normally, but I'm really getting everything I can out of it. Because if you don't make notes and you don't do something with them, you know, 10 years later, you might as well not have read the book. You'll retain very little. And with processing it like this, I feel like I never need to read the book again. My notes are complete. I've integrated it in all the things that I care about, and I can refer to the notes later if I have to.
How important are systems to creativity?
I think they're extraordinarily important. I think it's a really big and dangerous myth to think of creativity as something you have to wait for, or something that must be unconscious, that can't be forced. I think all those are myths, right? So I think that creativity comes from, the best creativity and the most productivity in terms of creativity comes from when you force yourself to actually try to be creative, even when, and especially when, you're not in the mood for it. I'll tell you just from my own experience. I just started a serial. I'm having a serial published in Altered Reality magazine, and it's a fantasy about mice trying to protect children from supernatural threats. And I've got an editor. It's a little like The Rescuers meets Ghostbusters or something. But I've got an editor who will give me criticism. They'll say, oh, you know, this doesn't work. This doesn't make sense. And sometimes their first thought will be like, oh God, but that's like the whole point of the chapter and da, da, da. And I'll tell you what happens is I don't feel like working on it. My mind will think, what else can I work on? And as a professor, I got a million other things I could possibly be working on. But that is exactly the most important time to get in there and solve the problem. But the way most of us think about creativity is like, oh, I guess I'm not inspired. I guess I'm not inspired right now. I'll wait till I'm inspired. But when are you going to be inspired to work on a difficult problem that you have no idea how to solve? It's, you know, if you wait for that, it's not going to happen. And sure enough, you know, I just have faith in myself and I sit there and bang my head against it until I come up with something, even if it's bad, and then maybe I'll make it a little bit better later. And before you know it, what I thought was this huge insurmountable problem was actually, I came up with a creative solution to it.
Yeah, and it's also a little bit about giving yourself the space to have the energy for that, right? So if you have to go, if you start working on Riveted to Religion and you had to go reread all those books that you've been reading in 15 years, well, you'll never get the book done, right? And also you'll just be exhausted thinking about it, right? How do people sort of discount the role of energy when it comes to sort of productivity in creative projects?
I think they do. And I think that my thinking has changed a little bit. I used to talk a lot about time management. And I'm thinking it more lately in terms of energy management. Because, you know, you have, and people are different about this. I was up at 4 o'clock this morning and I, you know, worked steadily till 8 a.m. when my wife woke up. And, you know, that's, you know, I just naturally wake up. I don't set an alarm. I just wake up way early. And I'm very productive at that time. And by the evening, I'm just exhausted and my mind is totally fried. Some people are the opposite. Some people work very late, but a lot of the most productive people either work very early or very late. But people have slumps during the day, right? A lot of people have a slump around 2 o'clock. And it's good to not really fight it. Take a nap. If you can't take a nap, have a coffee or something, or take a break. You know, studies show that breaks help. And something called incubation in creativity is a real thing. So if you work on something and you can't solve it, you take a break, you come back to it later, you might have better luck. But the important thing is in this kind of management is that you don't let it go for more than a few days. So let's go back to the writing problem, right? So if I've got a writing issue, my editor wants me to change something. I will try to work on it. And maybe I can't even come up with a solution, but I'll like put a half an hour banging my head against the wall, writing down ideas that are terrible. And then tomorrow I'll do the same thing. And what's good about that is that it keeps my mind in the game. Because if you don't do it every day, or at least every other day, your mind isn't going to subconsciously work on it. And you're not going to make connections and see opportunities in the other parts of your life that might help you with that. If you let it go for 2 weeks, your mind figures it doesn't even need to be solved. And it's not helping. Your subconscious is not helping you. So it's very important that you work on all of your most important projects every day. That's something I try to stress to everybody who will listen.
Mm-hmm. No, of course. And you didn't always have these processes in place and these strategies. What sort of drove that? What series of things kept kind of tugging at your sleeve to say, hey, Jim, maybe we need to work differently?
Well, I'm a real systematizer, so I'm always interested in systems and stuff. Back in the mid-90s, I guess, I even had this idea to write a book on, I was going to call it, what was it, the tools of geniuses, it was going to be some sort of a like meta strategies for being smart. And that really, I didn't write the book, of course, I was just starting graduate school, but it sort of preceded the whole life hack and productivity craze. But, you know, after a lot of these books and things came out, like Getting Things Done by Allen and 4-Hour Work Week and all these kinds of things, my mind was ready for that kind of stuff. But a lot of the strategies that I use actually are, you know, sometimes minorly inspired by other people, but I just came up with myself and you know, I add things every year and you can, you know, look back over the years and I can see when I've added some things and not, you know, and before I thought of others.
No, that's interesting. And what can others sort of learn from this? Most people don't even have a system maybe for how they work at their actual jobs, how they go through their emails. New technologies come through all the time, and they may not even have a system for their own cloud documents and things. But how can they find their own way to a system or a strategy to make the things that they want to happen? What would you suggest? What sort of either mindset should they have, or maybe first steps would you suggest?
The most important thing is actually making the optimization of your workflow a project in itself. So let's say that you have to use a new email software, or you have to, you know, whatever, or you want to use Pomodoro method or something like that. You know, make it a project that you work on every day until you figured it out, to effectively use that in your life. That's, you know, and just giving it a thought. So I can tell you what I do. It might not work for you, it might not work for everybody else, but you should come up with something, you know, and that something might be a decision not to do anything. I have a friend who worried for years about all his old photos that he never organized. You know, it's like, oh, someday I got to organize those photos. And then he just decided one day, I'm deciding not to ever organize my photos, right? And it doesn't matter that much that they're not organized. It's a little bit more work to find a photo that you actually need, but the amount of work it would take him to organize the photos and the amount of the lack of pleasure he would get in doing it, he just calculated that it wasn't worth it, right? So do you want to use your email box as a to-do list? Is that really the best way to do it? Some people do it, but they haven't decided to do it. And you should take time to make sure that the ways that you're dealing with your workflow are actual decisions that were decided upon and selected from options, rather than just what you inherited from your past self or your coworkers.
And that comes right back to managing energy, because at the end of the day, did you spend more of your creative time, you know, going through your inbox or working on the project that you think only you can do? You know?
Right, right. And with energy, you should put your highest energy time into the stuff you do, like doing the least, which is a little counterintuitive. But if you're feeling all jazzed and energetic, don't go play video games. You know, don't go play like an exciting video game. That's the time when you should be reading that really boring thing that requires an enormous amount of attention. It's when you're like so drowsy you can't even pick up your pencil that you might resort to playing a video game and then like recharge your batteries a little bit so you can get back to work. I mean, you can probably tell I'm a very achievement-oriented individual. I look at my leisure time and my socializing as ways of recharging my battery so I can get back to work. But you know, that's how I think about it. If I find myself full of energy and then just doing something fun, I'm like, wait a second. I need to be using this energy more effectively. And another example is like exercise or something like that. Exercise, you know, if you're really dogged, you know, maybe you can't do it, but if you're, you know, exercise often energizes people, you know? So if you're feeling a little bit of a slump at 2 o'clock, maybe you don't need a coffee, maybe you need a brisk walk. Even if you don't really feel like it, you know, I can almost guarantee that after 10 minutes of that brisk walk, you're going to be more alert and more awake. I use a treadmill desk, and part of the reason I use it is because it keeps me awake. Like, it's very hard to get sleepy when you're walking on a treadmill. Your legs get tired and you want lunch earlier. I can attest to that. But you don't get sleepy, you know? It's very hard to be sleepy while you're, you know, walking and writing a grant proposal at the same time.
Exactly, which I think is an interesting point, that the machine that we're using, which is our bodies and our brains, it's not like a computer that, you know, it gets tired and it needs to be tended to. And people have to be cognizant of that too.
That's right.
Well, that's all the time we have, Jim. Thanks again for everything. And for our listeners, to listen to more podcasts from this series, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud. And before we go, one last word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by BNY Mellon Wealth Management, who knows that your investment decisions define not just your future, but your legacy. BNY Mellon Wealth Management knows because they know you well. This gives them the insights to help grow, protect, and transfer your wealth. Visit their brand hub, Worth Knowing, on entrepreneur.com to learn more. Disclaimer, BNY Mellon is the corporate brand of the Bank of New York Mellon Corporation and its subsidiaries.